for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Sahar Delajani's debut novel is based on the true story of the author's own birth in 1983 in an Iranian prison. The novel details the lives of several political prisoners and their children who inherit their country's tenuous future. The book is titled Children of the Jacaranda Tree. Sahar Delajani joins me in the studio. You're welcome to be part of the program. You can call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to you and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm delighted. I gather that this story was really inspired by what happened to your own family. Tell us about your parents and what happened to them in 1983.
Right. My parents were actually active before the revolution, and so they participated in the revolution overthrowing the Shah.
How?
On the streets, giving out leaflets and talking to people. My dad was a student, so he just talked to people a lot. It was that sort of activism. And they continued to be active. They, this time politically, they were part of a political party. And but they continued because they didn't think that the Islamic regime was exactly the answer they wanted. The first few years of the revolution, after the revolution, some of these parties were actually tolerated, some of these political parties. So there was talk of democracy and so on. But in 1983, that all changed. And they arrested almost all political activists. My parents were arrested. And also a lot of my family members, my uncles and my aunts and so on. My mom was pregnant with me in 1983, so the first chapter of the novel, which is about a woman giving birth in jail, is actually my birth story. I had my mom tell me how it happened. And then, fortunately, they were released a few years after, but my uncle, my dad's brother, was still in prison. Yeah. And in 1988, he was one of those thousands of people who were executed in Nevin prison. We don't know the exact number. There's something between 4,000 to 12,000. And the reason we don't know is that because they were buried in mass graves. And those mass graves were there until a few years ago. Families kept going back wanting to, you know, just something because they didn't have anything. And unfortunately, just a few years ago, they came with a bulldozer and, like, took everything away. So now we don't even know where the bodies are.
Tell me about your mother's giving birth and then how long you were with her as an infant.
Yeah. So my mom, I was with her for about a month and a few weeks. Then I was given to my grandparents, my mom's parents, to be raised. And so was my cousin, because my aunt was also in prison and he was born 18 days after me. So we were both given to my grandparents. And so the story of the birth is quite similar to what I wrote in the novel. So they take her on a van to different hospitals until she's admitted to one. And they do interrogate her while she's going through labor. And then finally she gives birth. And then she goes back to prison on the same day. Like, she takes the baby, from the hospital to the prison on the same day.
It was extraordinary to me to read how truly heartless the prison guards were, and those even transporting her in this van to the prison, because clearly she was in agony. Her amniotic fluid broke. She was hard at labor, and yet she keeps addressing these guards as sister. Tell me about that. I was interested.
Well, actually, the guards, the prisoners were supposed to call the guards sister. Because after the revolution, there was this idea of everybody calling each other sister and brother, by the government. So it wasn't something that my mom chose to do. I mean, she had to do it. A lot of the time she didn't even know their names. So that was just the sort of a title they would use.
Was there ever a point at which doctors and nurses cared for her kindly during the birth process?
Well, the doctors and nurses, because they were part of the hospital, yes, I mean, the doctor was trying to actually keep my mom for a few days. She knew she was a prisoner and everything, but she wanted to keep her. She thought that it's dangerous for her to leave now. And the guard, the sister, didn't accept that. And so my mom, yes, she says that they tried to help. And there is a certain point that my mom, like, pinches her. I write that in the novel, that pinches her, that no, like, trying to tell her what the sister is saying is not true, that they don't have medication inside prison and so on. And the doctor understands that, you know, and then tries to convince the sister to... And but she doesn't win the battle.
How long were you in the care of your grandparents?
My mom was released about a year after, so about a year. But we stayed with my grandparents until my dad was released, about 2.5 years. So the very first years.
And what kind of education did you receive?
Well, I mean, I was very young, but the kind of education I received, I would say, was love. I mean, it was just, I really, all my life, I've been so much cared for. I always say, like, I've been overspoiled, and also my cousin and my brother, because our parents weren't there for those few years, like, they were just filling us with extra love, you know? They wanted to sort of make up for anything that we could be missing because our parents weren't there. So I'd say my education was that sense of solidarity is so important. Caring for others is so important. And sometimes we shouldn't always, I mean, you shouldn't always look at your own interests, and you would do anything for someone else. I think that's what I learned.
How long did you stay in Tehran after your parents were released?
We stayed actually for quite a long time. We left Iran in 96, even though my parents could have left earlier if they wanted to, because my mom's family were all in the States. My grandparents left just a few years after my parents were released. I mean, for years, my family was in the States for years, my mom's uncles and so on. But my parents decided to stay in Iran for some time because they wanted my brother and I to have an Iranian education.
Really?
Despite everything. They wanted us to learn how to read and write. They wanted us to learn, like, to write in calligraphy. They wanted us just get an idea of the culture, of the poetry. So then in 96, when I was 12 and my brother was 14, my mom decided it's time to go. And also because she wanted to be reunited with her family in California.
So the elementary school education you had was real quality.
I would say, because both at home and at school, because it's true that, I mean, we did, education changed a little bit, of course, after the revolution. We had the religion hours and the Quran hours. But the teachers were so dedicated. The teachers were the same, you know, so they wanted to teach us about poetry, about geography, all of those things. I mean, I would say I had a very high quality education at school. And at home, my parents would want us to learn anything that the school is not telling us. So books that you wouldn't be able to read. But I mean, by this, I don't mean anything. My dad, for example, would give me like Victor Hugo's books to read, or like the life of Thomas Edison, or, you know, all of these books that we couldn't, you know, at school we wouldn't read. And all of the poetry that was censored in literature books at school, we would all have all of that. So I would get different points of view from home at school.
But it's interesting to me that you, as a girl, were allowed to attend school.
Oh, yes, yes. Iranian women have always gone to school. Actually, the ironic thing, sort of, because it's an, you know, religious country now, and you wouldn't think that, but after the revolution, the Iranian revolution, we had a very high jump in not only school, but university presence of women. So now we 60% of university students are women in Iran. Because one reason is that a lot of maybe conservative families that before didn't feel comfortable to send their children, their daughters out, don't anymore. So they get, everybody went to school, you know. So we have a very high level of education in Iran. And if you go to Iran, talk to them, it's just such high level of sophistication and they're very cultivated. So yeah. That's how it is, actually.
And once you left Iran, you came here to the States.
Exactly, yes.
To live where?
In California, Northern California, close to San Francisco.
And you were there throughout your education because you actually went to Berkeley.
Exactly, yes, I did, yes.
All right. Sahar Delajani. When we come back, she's going to read from her new novel, based in part on her own early experience. It's titled Children of the Jacaranda Tree. Stay with us. And if you've just joined us, Sahar Delajani is with me. She was born in an Iranian prison where her mother had been taken. After her birth, she was taken by the guards and given to Sahar's grandparents where she lived, until both her mother and father were released from prison. Now she's written a novel. It's titled Children of the Jacaranda Tree. And Sahar, explain that title for us.
Right. Jacaranda trees are actually tropical trees, so they don't they're very rare in Iran. They definitely don't exist in Tehran. They exist in South Africa and Australia. But my grandmother once told me that she wanted one. I don't know where she had seen the picture. I don't know how she got to it.
It's a beautiful tree.
It's a beautiful tree. And she wanted one. And she planted one in her little garden in Tehran. But of course, the tree never made it because it's too cold. It's a mountainous city. But for me, as I was writing the novel, I kept remembering this fact. This fact of her wanting this tree and never getting this tree. And it reminded me of the Islam, of the Iranian revolution. Symbolically for me, the jacaranda tree my grandmother never had was like the Iranian revolution, because there was so much hope behind this revolution.
And the expectations.
And the expectations. And, you know, our parents thought that this revolution is going to be a beautiful jacaranda tree with beautiful flowers. And it didn't become what it was imagined to be, what they had fought for, you know. And so the children of the jacaranda tree are the children of the revolution, and more specifically, children of those activists who had participated in the revolution, but later on fall victim to it themselves.
And how do you think you were affected by, really, your early life in that revolutionary period?
Well, I think the prison, the fact that my parents were in prison, is something that we have carried with ourselves always. I don't remember much, of course, I was very young, but I've always heard stories, and I know that every decision my parents have made throughout their lives, ever since the prison years, have been affected by it, you know? So, I mean, for example, my father came out of prison and he was a top student before going to prison, and he couldn't go back to university. So there already life
because
of his act, exactly, his activism having been, because now they were marked as anti-revolutionaries. So at that point, he could not continue studying. And that already changes your life upside down. So, and for me as a child, I just always knew that I should not tell anyone about this, that there was the world inside the house where we could easily speak about everything. All my parents' friends were prison friends, but the world outside of the house, it was risky. Like my mom said, just don't ever tell anybody where your parents have been. And because of that, I never actually really made very intimate friendships with anyone, because I was scared that at a certain point it would just like, I can't help it anymore, and, you know, it will come out. And because of that, I mean, life changes like that, you know? And I always felt closer to the children of my parents' friends, because we all had that background, so we were free to say whatever we want. So that already, I think, creates this sort of suspicion toward everyone else in the country that you carry with you even later on, even though you're not, you know, you're in the States or in Italy and you know you don't face any sort of danger, but it's still in the back of your head. And so, but, you know, then you write a book about it and then things change.
Things change. Do you fear that there could be any repercussions from this book?
Well, probably. I don't know. I mean, you know, dictatorships work in this way. You don't know what you're afraid of. You don't know what risks you're running. And they count on that, this sort of paranoia we could get. But then the matter of the fact is that this is a book. It's not a political book. I don't think this is a political book. But it is about an event about which the government has never publicly admitted to, especially the number of the executed. You know, if there are thousands, they have never publicly admitted to that. So they wouldn't be so happy about it. So now my parents and a few friends are saying, you know, it's better not to go back to Iran for some time and just see how it's received and what happens.
What is life like for women now in Iran?
Well, I think life is very difficult for women in Iran. There are many, of course, there are many limitations. But at the same time, the Iranian women are some of the most active and brave women, people I have ever met. And they're fighting very, very hard for not only for women's rights, but just for civil rights, for human rights. So some of our most famous lawyers, human rights lawyers, are women. One of the most famous one is Shirin Ebadi, who won the Nobel Peace Prize a few years ago. So there is that. There are those limitations. But culturally, I think the entire country is much more ahead. Culturally, they're much more ahead than as regards laws. We have laws against women. There are jobs they cannot do, like become the president or become a judge. But culturally, people are just like beyond that, you know? And I think men and women right now are fighting side to side, side by side for everybody's rights.
Would you read for us from the novel?
Definitely, yes. I
and
actually, yeah.
Set up for us where you're going to read.
Well, I have chosen a piece which is from the second chapter, where it's a moment of arrest, basically. They come and take the parents of this little boy away, and they're having lunch. And this actually happened to many families, because there were no warnings or anything. They just sort of broke into the house and took Tuki away. And so this is what this little section is about. This was how Leila found Omid, wide-eyed, taut-limbed, and sucking ferociously on his fingers. He was sitting at the dining table, surrounded by a ravished house. All of the doors were flung open. The cabinets and drawers had been gutted on the floor. There were books and papers and clothes everywhere, and envelopes and hairpins and pens and shoes. On some of Parisa's clothes, there were dusty boot prints. Omid had been there when his parents were arrested. They were having lunch. The sky was blue, without a cloud, featureless. The air smelled of approaching heat. The season seemed about to turn on its hinges. Omid's father was mashing the meat and chickpeas and potato in a steel bowl, pestle in hand, fingers curled around the bowl, steam rising to his chin. Omid dipped his finger into the bowl of yogurt that was blended with crushed rose petals. Parisa frowned at him. "How many times have I told you to use a spoon?" Omid didn't know what to do with his finger, with the wrong that had already been done. So it lingered in the bowl, where the yogurt felt cold and soft. He looked at his mother, at her beautiful eyes and luscious hair that cascaded over her shoulders, at the lovely purple blouse that enhanced the rosiness of her cheeks and fell over the growing bulge of her stomach, at the love that seemed to spill out of her eyes and submerge everything. "It's okay," Parisa said. "Your finger's already in the bowl, but next time use your spoon." Omid lifted the finger to his mouth and tasted yogurt and roses. That was when the landlady appeared at the door, flanked by two officers. She was pale, her eyes wide with terror. She spoke hurriedly, compulsively fixing her chador and pleading and saying words that had lost all sense in the face of her fear. The guards came in and simply took his parents away. Omid was left at the table with the meal in front of him. Parisa had touched his face fleetingly, her fingers cold as ice. His father had placed a kiss on his forehead and told him not to be afraid, that they'd come right back. But his voice was so thin that something inside Omid made the quiet plop and vanished forever. The guards had been looking for documents, letters, leaflets, poems, forbidden books. They left with their hands full. There were so many pieces of life that had to be carried away. Those papers were now going to decide who went and who stayed. His parents, with their love and their fight and their papery lives, were gone. And Omid sat at the table, the chaos around him. He couldn't cry. He sat there shaking, saliva running down his fingers. The landlady ran after the guards, who pulled his parents away, handcuffed and blindfolded. They were not pulling hard because his parents were not resisting. They were not flailing their arms. They were not screaming. It was all quiet, like a Sunday morning in a mosque. It was as though they had been waiting for it, his parents, for the guards, to come and make a shambles of their home and their life and the child who was left behind and the child who was yet to come, to ravage through it all and spew everything onto their faces. Only later, when her voice died in her throat, her words lying lifeless at the doorsteps, did the landlady run to the phone to call Aghajan and Maman Zinat. And Omid sat, alone, with half-mashed stew and a bowl of yogurt in front of him that smelt of roses.
And that is the voice of Sahar Delajani reading from her new novel. It's titled Children of the Jacaranda Tree. And we will take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Tell us about Leila and who she is?
Well, I base the character of Layla on many of the aunts who were around when children were coming from prison, basically. And my aunt, for example, was there. She was a young woman, and she helped out my grandparents to raise us. But, you know, I talked to many of my friends who were in the same situation, and they said, yes, you know, they were raised by their grandparents. There was always an aunt or an uncle around. So it was about, you know, the fact that it wasn't only the victim's life that turns upside down, but everybody, all those people who are directly or indirectly involved in that tragedy, their life changes forever. And they have to make huge sacrifices. And I wanted people to know that, you know, it's a huge family of people, a community of people that have to make decisions.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. How long did those abductions go on?
Well, I mean, all the imprisonments were happening even before 83. And it was, but the huge, like, bulk of it was in 83, but it was constant. After the revolution, it just started, and it continued to 88. But the fact is that we still have people in prisons, young people now after the 2009 movements, activists, journalists who are in prison now. So, I mean, in a way, we're still living that same reality.
Do you believe that the new president of Iran could make a difference?
Well, I hope so. I do hope so, because there is a lot of people energy behind him, and people are putting pressure on him. And I hope that, you know, sometimes you are a certain person and people turn you into another person. And I hope he listens to those voices. And even if he releases one political prisoner, that's still a good step. Mm-hmm.
You were actually in Iran 2010, the 30th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in 2009.
Yeah.
Talk about what you saw and how you felt being back there.
Well, I love being back in Iran. There's really nothing for me, nothing more beautiful, because it's a country of amazing energy. It's a country of intelligent, active young people. So every time I go back to Iran, I come back wanting to do something, anything. You know, I feel like that energy has been injected into me as well. But when I went to Iran, it was after the all the protests and the crackdown. So there was also a sense of despair. I mean, everybody was very sad. It was that sense, just simply sadness. But at the same time, and that's what is just amazing about Iranians, that they never lose hope. So my sense was that they had taken a step back to sort of see, okay, what is the next move we have to make? What is the next opportunity we have to grasp? And my sense now, I'm glad because that sense was correct, because we saw what happened with that huge participation in these elections. So that's Iran. I mean, it's a country that never stops fighting.
All right. Let's open the phones, take a call from Jesse in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on your show,
Diane. Surely.
So, Sahad, I just wanted to tell you thank you for writing this book and talking on the show. I work with children. I'm a teacher, and I work with a lot of children from different backgrounds. And what I've been noticing is that specifically children from Middle Eastern backgrounds encounter a lot of troubles when they come here in terms of dealing with the way their countries are portrayed in the media, or just the general relations between the U.S. and whatever country they or their parents come from, and kind of, you know, finding a way to mix that with being in a new country and with powers of assimilation and whatnot. And I'm just wondering what your experience was when you came to California, and how you either battled or did not battle against compromising what people believed your country to look like in your experience. And
Yeah. Hi. Thank you for your question. Well, to be honest, in California, when I moved to California, I mean, there's such mixed of people and races and countries and religions that I did not feel left out. I mean, there were so many Middle Easterns there as well. So I have to say those few years, I did not. I actually never felt that sort of conflict.
And you already spoke English, I gather.
Well, no, in the beginning, I didn't,
you
actually.
I did not.
Uh-huh. No, so we went to ESL courses in the beginning.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Sahar Delajani. And we're talking about her new novel, Children of the Jacaranda Tree. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
How was the Obama campaign able to beat Mitt Romney in 2012? Journalist Jonathan Alter says it was in part by ignoring the human desire not to be irritating with online fundraising appeals. On the next Fresh Air, Alter talks about what he calls the most consequential election of recent times. His new book is The Center Holds. Join us.
And if you've just joined us, Sahar Delajani is with me. Her new novel, based to a certain extent on her own life experience, is titled Children of the Jacaranda Tree. It's a tree that does not grow in Iran, which is where she was born, but it represents for her something beautiful, something longed for, as those who saw the revolution in Iran hoped for and indeed longed for. Just before the break, we were talking about what you faced when you arrived here in the United States. You were 12 years old.
I was 12 years old, exactly. And, you know, it was all much fun. I never felt left out or anything. And it's very mixed community at my school. But I have to say, after 9/11, things did change. We needed to justify ourselves almost a little bit. I remember I felt very afraid the next stage, even to show my face, because there was such tension around. I mean, you know, I thought I would look Middle Eastern or something, but that's also paranoia you get, you know. It wasn't because something had happened to me, but I just felt very worried. And I remember after that, this sort of this sort of, not attacks, but even could be jokes, you know, like even toward my brother or so on. And we always try to laugh it off, you know, it's not good to provoke or anything. But I did feel like there was a change, that we weren't a little bit now different, that sometimes we could even pose a threat somehow or our country. And so I would say my adult age was different from my childhood.
So did people make direct comments to you, or was it more something you sensed?
It was, no, something I sensed. I never had any direct comment. But like my brother, if he grew his beard, if he hadn't shaved or something, I would remember like we would call him, Osama, come here, you know, things like that, which is, it could also be a joke, but it wasn't that pleasant, you know. So these were the things. So because of those little things, one starts feeling a little bit, not nervous, but somehow that you need to defend yourself, that there could be a possible situation where you need to justify yourself for nothing, you know. And that's what I would say happened afterwards.
All right, to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Jim.
Well, thank you, Diane. This is wonderful. My question is, much of the culture of the Middle East is inherited from the Persian Empire. And I was curious to how she felt the Persians themselves, the Iranis, how much of their culture do they attribute to the advent of Islam in Iran? Thank you.
Yeah.
Surely.
Well, I would say that, you know, now it's mixed. I mean, I think when cultures sort of meet each other, either through war or through peace, there's give and take. So I'm sure the Persian Empire, like 2,500 years ago, gave a lot to not only to the Middle East, but I mean, to the world, just like many other empires and civilizations at the time did. But at a certain point, and when Islam came, they brought in, I mean, they gave the alphabet. We used the Arabic alphabet at that point. So I think it's a mix. And I'm not an expert, actually. I'm not a very good historian. But I believe that there is of that Persian culture in the Islamic culture and vice versa.
All right. To Wichita, Kansas. Hi, Rosa.
Hi, Diane. First, I want to tell you I love your program. Oh. I wish it was 24/7.
Oh, thank you.
And I want to congratulate Sahar. I'm from Iran. I was the first generation that I moved to this culture, and so many children were sent to me, and I just came before, a few years before revolution happened. I just want to congratulate you and tell you, please, as much as you could, talk and be active. Anywhere you go, we need women like you. We need a lot of people, men and women, to talk about where they're coming from, how the experiences of life and hardship is, so we could relate to each other better and try to respect each other and get along with each other. We need women as much as possible to write about their life, especially Iranian women.
Rosa, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Kheli mamnoon, Rosa.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Now, in the second half of the book, Neda and the other characters evolve. Tell us about their lives.
Exactly. Yes, the second half of the novel is about those children who are now all grown up, and it's about their interpretation of what happened, their feelings about their parents' experience either before the revolution and afterwards, and how, in the looking at that past and now looking at their present, because the second half revolves around the 2009 protests and seeing everything repeating itself, what is their idea of making now their own history? What is their idea of the future of the country? Where they want to take the country? How they want to finish what was left undone, what was started by their parents and was left undone, and sort of now it is their turn to turn history to their side in a way. So, but the interesting part was that while I was writing the first half of the novel, all of that protest was happening in front of my eyes. So it was a sort of an historical coincidence I couldn't ignore easily. But it was very heartwarming for me, because when we were in Iran, I always felt, my family and their friends, we were part of the minority, you know, that who were always against the regime, who had fought against the regime since the beginning. The rest of the country, I mean, there were some who tolerated it. There were some who didn't think it was, I mean, you know, of course, it's a big society, so it's very mixed. But we did feel like a minority. What happened was that now that the children were grown up, all of the children from every side, from the minority or the majority side, from the government or the anti-government side, were now on the streets together. And for me, that's what the Green Movement was. It was sort of a national reconciliation for me in those days on those streets. And I didn't feel like, if we were always on the wrong side of history, they were now on the wrong side with us.
Now, after you went back, what did you feel?
I felt like, oh my God, I want to stay. Because, I don't know, there's this almost a daily struggle in Iran, you know? I mean, even culturally, every day, like, they want to find a way to fight what is limiting them culturally, politically, economically, and so on. And that, to me, is amazing. That energy is amazing. And so that is my feeling. My feeling was that if this is the country that I see, if this is, these are the people I know, this country will change. It's impossible.
What about the presence of the Taliban?
Well, the Taliban are not in Iran. They're in Afghanistan. In Iran, there is a very hardliner fundamentalist government, but they're not like the Taliban. It's completely different from many points of view. I mean, it's much more sophisticated than the Taliban, because the Taliban were just, I mean, it was just a completely different way of thinking. And they're still there. But although this fundamentalist government is still there and is telling everybody what to do at all times, you know. So there's also that. I mean, when they tell people that you cannot drink alcohol and you cannot have party, just to use as an example, people just, you know, buy really, really thick curtains and just cover everything and have the biggest parties I've ever seen inside the house. So that's what I mean by that daily struggle.
But as you look at the young people and as you look at those who are in charge, I mean, is there a disconnect between the two?
I think by now, completely. I mean, it's a disconnect as in they just don't want the same thing, you know? The government and their people want to be able to tell everybody what to do, want to stop Iran from culturally, especially, growing. They don't want people to read books coming from the outside, even from inside Iran. Books get censored. They don't get permission to be published, movies and so on. And on the other side, the young people just have had about enough. And internet has helped a lot. So anything we see and read outside of Iran, they get it all. They get it before us. And that was the amazing part. I could talk about any film, any TV series even, that, you know, we watched in America or in Italy, and they knew all about it. And there are all these discussions about Lost, for example, on Facebook, you know. So their world is another world. I think it's too late, you know. That's why this government cannot survive so much. I don't know how long. Maybe they'll survive another 10 years, but already it's over for them culturally.
As you were writing this book, did you talk to family members? And did they have any concerns about your writing, it revealing what was going on, feeling that you could be putting not only yourself but them in some sort of danger by the long arm of Iran?
Sure. Yes, I did speak to my parents about the book, and when I wanted to write actually the two chapters that are based on specifically on their experience. And my mom was worried. It was very difficult for my mom to talk about it. I mean, it was a very traumatic experience being, you know,
I should
pregnant in prison. It's not even the easiest thing. But she was also worried. She's always been worried for us that somehow what happened to them could happen to us somehow. It's always been in the back of her mind. And but you know, the fact is that it was such a painful experience, and they lived it in silence, you know, during and after. They never talked about it. I mean, my father's lost a 27-year-old brother of his without ever being able to even see the body, you know. So at that point, there's almost a sense of you don't care. You're not afraid anymore. You've just lost so much that you, the idea was, let's get the world to know this. And so when this book has such reception, you know, being published all over the world. Yes. So that is the biggest satisfaction, not because it's a success, which is, of course, just a magnificent thing, but that this story, this huge tragedy that happened and was so long buried exactly like those bodies is now out in the open. And I think everyone is very happy about that.
And do you think your mother was able to get over her fears?
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing, actually. Yes, what happened was that finally, after many times, she told me about it. And she got over her fear while it was a process. And the most amazing part was that in the beginning, I mean, she would just say a little bit, then that night she would have nightmares and she couldn't talk about it anymore. Then once we got to the end of it, and once especially she read it, she said to me, "I have many more stories to tell you."
Ah.
And that was, for me, that was the success of the book.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Mehdi in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Dan. I'm a long-time listener, and today is the first chance that I have to talk to you. I really enjoy your show.
I'm so glad. Thank you
very much. I'm teaching in a university close to you, and I'm following Iran's situation. I'm part of the Green Movement in Iran, and I really have to admire the job that Sahar has done. And the reason I'm saying this, because at that age, with that experience, somebody comes, you know, out of Iran, usually they are bitter about, you know, their experience. But Sahar has done a wonderful job to pass those things, to become passionate about, you know, the experience that she had is very, very admirable. Election in Iran, as Sahar, of course, referred to it, perhaps this is another discussion. Many in the West tried, you know, to discredit it, but I follow, of course, and I support what, you know, Sahar said. That election was not an ordinary election. In a sense, that was a silent revolution. That was a referendum. And if you ask anybody in the Iranian street today why they voted for moderation and against radicalism. And that is a huge thing.
A huge thing.
Huge thing, yes. Thank you so much. خیلی ممنون, Mehdi, for your message. Yeah, because this sort of passion, which is true that I do have very much for Iran, is, I mean, I've learned it from my parents that, you know, despite all their experience, they still wanted us to, you know, be Iranians and learn about Iran and learn about the culture. And then later on from the Iranians that despite everything, they just have so much love for their country. And I think Iran is a different story from its government, you know?
And yet now you are living in Italy.
Yes.
With your husband.
Exactly.
What about the economic sanctions? To what extent are they reaching the people and not those in charge?
They're reaching very much the people. It's a very, very sad thing that is happening in Iran. I mean, I hear this through conversations with friends and also the news. And something that I just thought, okay, this is wrong, was that I found out through friends and then later on was confirmed through the news that people who are cancer patients don't have medication anymore. And that to me is just wrong. And no matter the entire country, I mean, with the economics, and there's so much going on right now, and it's such a dire situation. But when I heard that, I thought, okay, there's something wrong with the way they're doing this.
So do you believe there's hope for negotiation?
I hope that there is hope for negotiations. And I think there should be now. I mean, the Iranians are idealist and realistic at the time. And I don't think that, oh, now it's going to be all, you know, pretty and we're all going to get in around a table and talk. But I do think just one little door has opened.
I hope you're right. Sahar Delajani, her brand new novel, it's been published all over the world, but I assume not in Iran. It's titled Children of the Jacaranda Tree. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.